So happy New Year. Heck, happy new century. Happy new millennium. That is, if you're using their calendar. If you're using the Buddhist calendar, well, have a nice day. This is going to be a little bit different than my usual Dharma talk. You'll see in a few minutes how, in what ways. I'm going to develop a metaphor for something. So bear with me. It's going to look really strange in the beginning. Hopefully it won't be quite so strange as we go along. When I was thinking about the New Year Dharma talk, I remembered that occasionally at this time of the year, if you're watching TV or listening to radio or something of that sort, you see someone in a sort of public position wishing that we have a safe and sober New Year. And that, of course, is referring to, hey gang, let's not drink and drive, let's get through this in one piece, which is excellent advice. But it got me to thinking about the topic of sobriety. And so, the more I thought about it, the more intriguing this became. And what you're going to get this morning, ladies and gentlemen, is a good old-fashioned temperance lecture. Yes, I'm going to speak to you on the evils of drugs and the demon rum. And I should know the depths of degradation they can bring you down to, because, ladies and gentlemen, I am a drug addict. That's right, a drug addict, a junkie. For many years in my wasted youth, I shot up speed. Uppers, ladies and gentlemen. Those drugs that make you feel power, that make you feel in control, that make your mind race and make you feel alive. I note my physician here is wondering, is there something I didn't tell him? Hang on. Now, in this world, there are many types of uppers. And I will not be trying to describe them all to you. Many types of addictive drugs of this variety. Let me start with the one that was my drug of choice. And that is the drug of knowledge. Yes, I was a knowledge addict. Knowledge is, as they say, power. I know more than you do. I have power. And in fact, I am right. And there is nothing sweeter in this world and more addictive than the wine of being right. And over the course of time, this led me into greater and greater degrees of addiction to knowledge. There were times, and I am literally telling you, describing this accurately, there were times when I was so high on knowledge that my mind would race to the point where I couldn't sleep and I could barely eat for the excitement and the power of what I was finding out. Indeed, it got almost to the point where I was on the edge of the very skid row of knowledge, the absent-minded professor. Now, you may think that the absent-minded professor is a quaint and eccentric sight, but let me tell you, having been very close and having known many, the absent-minded professor is drunk. But fortunately, I saw the light. And so, for some years now, I have been sober in this regard. Therefore, we may refer to me, perhaps, as a recovering intellectual. But I say I introduce myself as an addict because, as anyone who has had trouble with literal drugs or alcohol will know, it's not a question of whether you are, for instance, an alcoholic or not. It's only a question of whether you are a drunk one or a sober one. In other words, there is this tendency, there is this pull, there is this temptation. And for me, knowledge will always be there as my temptation. So I have to be a bit careful, lest I start drinking too deeply in this area and become drunk again. Because if I do, I will go right back to the state I was in before I gave it up. This, by the way, is not uncommon. I'm thinking of Reverend Master Geo, my master, who was a musician. And we would ask her to write music for some of these lovely liturgies and litanies and hymns that you sing, which she agreed to do some of the time, and adapt some and write some. And she would always look at me with this little look in her eye. She said, "Well, all right, but I've got to be careful." Because she could very easily, and she knew she could very easily, slip right back into being drunk with music and totally lose all proportion in music, as that was her addiction. And always, she was just a little careful along those lines, as I need to be when I get involved in things intellectual. Now that, like any good addict, generally one does not have only one drug of choice. There are several other types of speed that I have shot in my life into my veins. One of the foremost other ones is the drug of anger. Now, anger is raw power. It is energy. You get so high, so fast on anger. And you know what? You wouldn't get angry if you weren't right, would you? So there's that one again. The sweet wine of being right. And anger will justify almost anything you do, at least at the time. So not only is there power, but there is this ability to do all sorts of things which you later regret. And there are many others. There is, for example, the drug of physical strength. You feel strong. When you're strong, you're in control. You feel good. You feel invincible. You even feel immortal, particularly when you're young and male and strong. It doesn't last, ladies and gentlemen, but while you are on that high, you're really into it. And you'll do almost anything to stay there. Similarly, there is the drug of beauty, physical beauty. You are wanted. They will do almost anything to be with you. You have the world on a string. You have power. Again, you are special. You are beautiful. Until it starts to fade. And that's when the desperation comes in. There is the drug of lust. Similar to the two above. Lust, sexual lust, is power. You are alive. You feel in control again. Now, I'm not speaking here of the affections of committed couples. I'm speaking of the lust that knows no bounds and that is addictive. There is the drug, for instance, of blind certainty. Heck, you don't need that knowledge stuff to be right. You can just be right. It doesn't matter whether it's idealism or whether it's bigotry. Right is right. When you are right, you are in control. You are speeding. You have power, and anything goes. And then, of course, just to mention one more, you know what they do say about money. Money is power. Another addictive type of speed. Now, I refer to these as addictive drugs. Are they? Are they actually addictive? Well, I would say you betcha they are. You like the feeling? Have some more. It doesn't last, does it? You come down. What's the answer to that? Well, have another fix. Stay high at all costs is the addict's motto. Because if you don't, you start to see what you've been doing to yourself and to others, and that is that you've been harming yourself and others, and that is simply too painful. So stay high at all costs. It is an addiction. It is also impossible to get enough. Think of your favorite addiction, if you are a speed freak like me, among those. There are other classes of drugs I'll get to in a minute, for those of you who aren't into uppers. Think of it for a moment. Can you ever get enough? I know as a scholar, I could never get enough. I didn't know any scholar who knew enough and was content. I've never known a tough guy who was strong enough. I've never known a beautiful person who was beautiful enough. And is there such a thing as enough sex or enough money? Uh-uh. These are addictive drugs. And another reason they're addictive is there is always underlying them this inner nagging sense that actually you aren't in control. And that inner nagging sense must be drowned out at all costs because it is, once again, too painful. Now, I mentioned that uppers are not the only addictive drugs out there. We have the downers. Now, I've never been as appealing. These have never been as appealing to me because they're not as much fun. But they can be just as addictive. And I probably don't know them as well because I'm a speed freak. I'm not a downer freak. But the way it looks to me is that downers have in common, instead of control and I'm in charge and power, they have in common, don't blame me, I'm not responsible. For instance, there is the drug of incompetence or inadequacy. Hey, don't look at me, I can't do it. You wouldn't expect me to do the impossible, would you? Training is too hard. I'd do it if I could. I just don't have what it takes. So, I don't have to. I'm not responsible. There's the drugs of dejection, depression, despair, call them what you will in there. You can't expect me to do this when I'm down. I mean, would you kick a guy when he's down? I can't do this. I'm not responsible. I'm down. There is the drug of fear. Well, I'd do it if it wasn't so scary. But I'm too scared. I can't do it. It's too frightening. I can't do it. I can't take responsibility for my life. I can't do training. It's simply too scary. There's things I just can't face. I'd do it if I could. So I'm not responsible. There's the I'm worthless. I'm no good. I am a failure. Don't tell me I'm a failure. I already know I'm a failure. I've already said it first. You can't hurt me anymore. And what can you expect from a failure? You can't expect this. You can't expect responsibility and to do practice from a failure. I already know I'm a failure. There is weakness and imaginary illness, not real illness, imaginary illness. Well, I'm doing the best I can. Mind you, real illness is a very different matter. In terms of Buddhist training, you just continue training in a somewhat different way. You accept what there is and go on with it as you can. The forms may change, but training is training. But the drug of imagined illness or weakness is very seductive because, once again, you aren't responsible. You can't be held responsible for what you can't do, so the drug says. These two are addictive drugs because there's always something else the training wants you to do. There's always one more thing that has to be avoided. Oh, I thought I avoided them all. And now you give me another one. It's no fun being on downers, but at least it's less painful, one thinks, than facing the awful thing. There always seems to be an awful thing amongst downer addicts. You often can't figure out what the awful thing is. I'm not even sure there always is one. But there always seems to be an awful thing which is gotta be worse than being on downers. To be sober has gotta be worse than this, because there's the awful thing. Sometimes there's also that lovely little whine of concern and sympathy one gets from others when one's on the downers. That doesn't usually last too long, but it's pretty heady while you're drinking it. And again, this inner sense that goes against what you're telling yourself. In the case of the downer addict, the inner sense that in fact you are responsible for your own life and your own training. That's the inner sense that has to be drowned out by staying high. Because otherwise, you would realize what an utter waste you are making of your life. And how you hurt others and yourself, not by doing, as in case of the speed freak, but by not doing. Then there's our third major class of drugs, the psychedelics. Hey man, don't bug me, I'm elsewhere. There is the drug of fog. You can't reach me in here, I'm nowhere. I can't even find me. Where there's no contact, there's no pain. There's the drug of trick mirrors. You know, the mirrors you see in old-fashioned sideshows, carnivals? The ones that make the fat things thin and thin things fat and turn things upside down. As our scriptures say, sometimes it looks like black is white and white is black. Well, these applied to one's training come up with such conclusions as, my life isn't in a mess because of my training, it's your fault. Everything would be fine if they'd only stop that. Hey, I don't need to be fixed, you do. Then there's the drug of what I call moonbeams. Let's see now, if I could just rearrange these moonbeams so they shone over on these cobwebs here, then the light would be really supernatural and everything would be great. You know, hey, don't bother me. I'm dealing with moonbeams here. This is important. Don't talk to me about Buddhist training. This is moonbeams. Life is not the problem. The real problem is moonbeams. If only people would understand this. A complete diversion from what's actually going on. There is the drug of, hey, what's the problem? Everything's just fine here. There's no problems here. I'm okay, you're okay, everything's okay. Why do you insist on looking at stuff? Why do you insist on talking about becoming aware of what's inside? Why do you talk about precepts and things? It's fine, just the way it is. Please, leave me alone. These two are addictive. Again, they never last. Just like any addictive drug. And another fix and another is needed. There's always some new intrusion threatening to break through the fog or crack the mirrors. As Dogen says, always we must be disturbed by the truth. He's saying always we must allow the truth to disturb us. This is the one thing that the junkie will not allow. Not allow the truth to disturb one. But the truth will disturb one. One has to choose. Is one going to be disturbed, or is one going to take another fix? And again, an inner sense that something isn't right. And that inner sense, again, must be avoided by staying high. Otherwise, one tends to see that one has done kind of both of what the downer addict and the upper addict have done. One has wasted a great deal of one's life, and one has harmed others both by doing and by things undone. Now, those are the sorts of three ways of looking at the drugs, the hard drugs. But as any good addict can tell you, you don't just shoot up the hard stuff. You're constantly smoking a little of this and a little of that, just to take the edge off, you know. And these are the minor drugs that you sort of smoke now and again. Heck, you don't smoke them now and again. I smoke them all the time. The distractions. There's a million of them. I go around talking to myself inside my head. Heck, I go around singing to myself inside my head. We wrap ourselves up in our emotions. We wrap ourselves up in daydreams, in fantasies, in procrastination, etc., etc., etc. These are the minor drugs, the everyday things that we can do literally all day long, every day, if we don't do something about it. And we will do that, exactly that, to avoid being stone cold sober. Well, to return to the temperance lecture side of things a bit more, ladies and gentlemen, there is a path to recovery. Now, there are many ways in literal drug addiction and alcoholism for recovery, but I'm going to push our metaphor a little bit here. And for those of you who aren't familiar with them, haven't been either involved personally or in the business of mental health, I'm going to translate into quasi-Buddhist terminology the 12 steps of AA. And I'm going to do that for two reasons. One is because it's very interesting how close this is to what we do. And two, it shed some light on this metaphor of self as a drug, which is really what we're talking about here, attachments as drugs. Because you will, I think, find it interesting to see how probably the most effective method ever devised thus far for dealing with literal drugs and alcoholism, how close that comes to what we do to try to deal with the drugs of attachment. Now again, now as I say, I'm not going to push the metaphor too far because it will break down at a certain point. And I am going to translate a bit because the terminology of AA is a quasi-Christian terminology, although they make it very clear that they are not talking about God in a sense that is restrictive, but rather in a very wide sense, which includes non-Christians as well. God as we come to know him, they say. But listen to these 12 steps as they may pertain to dealing with the drugs and drinks of attachment and self. The first step is to admit that you are an addict, to admit that you are an alcoholic, and that nothing you can do can or has fixed that. In other words, until you admit it squarely, there is no hope of change. It's a very important point for them, and pretty important for us. The first noble truth, the truth of suffering. If you don't get it, if you don't get the truth of the unsatisfactoriness of this way of going about things, what is the point of doing all this hard work? You won't be terribly likely to continue with it. So the first point is to admit to oneself that one is a drunk. And the second part of this first step is to admit that all the fixes you've tried, all the little tinkerings and mechanical adjustments, haven't dealt with it. In other words, it's bigger than what you can fix. And again, this is very useful for us because the tendency is to try to fix oneself, to try to fix the self. And fixing the self isn't going to work in Buddhist training, because the self is the problem. And fixing the problem so that it works better isn't going to deal with the problem. It's just going to be a problem that ticks better. So the first step, admitting that one is an addict and that this is bigger than what I can fix. This is bigger than what I can handle on my own. Their second step is to find faith in something. They call it a higher power or God. We can call it a Buddha nature. We can call it the Eightfold Path. We can call it that which is. We can call it the unborn, the eternal, what you will. A faith that something can deal with this. Okay? In a sense, the Buddha's entire teaching. Do you believe that this guy actually did find the cause and cure of suffering or not? If you believe it, you've got a faith there. If you even are willing to try to follow it and see what happens, you've got a faith. But there is a faith aspect in here, a faith that there is the possibility that something does know what it's doing here. It's not me, but the Buddha nature may know. Something knows what it's doing, and something can deal with this. The third step, as I translate it, is a little bit different depending on whether you're on uppers or downers or elsewheres. If you're on the uppers, this third step is to step out of the driver's seat. In other words, to turn your life over to the Buddha mind, the Buddha nature, to stop trying to be in control. If you're hiding behind downers, then it's not a question of driver's seats, it's stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the excuses and turn your life over to the Buddha within. If you're in the elsewhere, then you got to get out of the elsewhere long enough to be able to make a deep commitment to that something. And again, to relinquish control, to relinquish what one is doing to that something in which you have faith. And one of the things they point out in AA about this is there can be no half measures at this step. You can't hold on to part of the control. And I dearly love that. I mean, I know that one very well. Well, you can have everything, Lord, but not that. Or, I know what to do, you know. I want it this way. Okay? Nope. No half measures in this one. Won't work, as they say in the big book, if there are half measures at this point. You've got to be willing to give up self, in other words. Step four is to look clearly at oneself, and what they call it taking moral inventory, but to me it sounds a lot like what we do in terms of facing our karma squarely. Take stock of what you've done. Look at it. Look at you and your actions in this lifetime, and face them squarely. No more excuses, no more looking away. The fifth step is trust. Trust enough to stand up squarely in the face of the Buddha or God and oneself, and very important point which they make here in AA about, and at least one other human being. Self, God, and at least one human being. Stand up squarely in the presence of these beings and let them know who you are. Trust them enough
to be fully transparent, as we would say, to let them see you for who you are.
That one other human being, at least one other human being, can be one's partner, can be one's teacher, can be a good spiritual friend. But there's got to be at least one person in this whole wide universe that you can trust enough to show yourself to. Step six is to be willing to let go of our attachments.
Right, okay.
But note the words, willing to let go. Not trying to fix the attachments, not trying to force the attachments. The words in AA are to be entirely ready to let go. Very lovely. What we would refer to as willing to let these things drop. And that leads naturally to their seventh step, which is to ask for help in so doing. After all, if you do have faith, and you do have trust, and there is something greater, and you are willing to let go, then it makes sense at this point to ask for help in doing that. Steps 8 and 9 sound a lot like two aspects of what we would think of as one thing, which we would call Sangha. Sangha being a word which is roughly translated as contrition. Step 8 is to examine one's actions and their consequences more fully and to clearly see all those that one has harmed. Okay, this is a sort of extension of one of the other steps, to continue that, in other words, to look even more closely, and in particular to look at the harm that one has done. And step 9 is to make amends when possible, actual direct amends when that will be of benefit, and not to be too proud to say that one is wrong. You put those two together and it sounds a lot like Sangha. To look at what one has done squarely, to allow oneself to feel the pain of having harmed other beings, to do something about it, and in that, to deepen one's resolve not to continue in that way. Which leads Buddhism to undertaking the precepts, to undertaking a perceptual life. Interestingly, in the way of recovery of addictions, their step 10 is to continue, quote, to continue to take this personal inventory, and when we are wrong, to promptly admit it. Okay? Sounds a lot like precepts. It's not as general as precepts. It is more general as precepts. Precepts have some specific guidelines that are specific to our religion. But the undertaking of perceptual life is the undertaking of a constant personal inventory and admitting when we've blown it. Very interesting, step 11. To seek only to know God and to live solely for that, relying on nothing else. To seek only the unborn. To seek only the Buddha nature, to seek for nothing other than that, to live for nothing other than that, to have nothing, to want nothing, to know nothing. And there, number 12, to practice all these things continually in all aspects of one's life, to apply them to everything, and to share with others. Sound familiar? Pretty interesting. Now that is a program for literal recovery from literal drug addiction and alcoholism. It's not very far off for a pretty darn good program for recovering from the drugs and drinks of self, of attachment. Indeed, one could say that Zen training, Zen practice, is the practice of radical sobriety. That's our goal, ladies and gentlemen. Radical sobriety. What do I mean by radical sobriety? I mean the elimination of attachment. And you can look at attachment in a number of different ways. One of the traditional helpful ways was even referred to in some of the scriptures this morning, of the three poisons of greed, anger, and delusion. And that is very useful, and that is the most traditional way of looking at these things. Actually, what I've been doing this morning is simply dividing up attachment in a slightly different way. Instead of dividing it into greed, anger, and delusion, and calling it the three poisons, I've divided it up into power, inadequacy, and elsewhere, and called it the three addictive drugs. But it's the same stuff. It's just a different way of looking at the same stuff. Because the fundamental problem is attachment. And attachment, interestingly enough, not only leads to suffering. I mean, we know that from the Second Noble Truth. Attachment leads to suffering. Craving leads to suffering. In other words, when we are acting from attachment, acting from craving, we do things which produce harm to self and other. I think it actually goes further than that. Not only is attachment that which leads to suffering, but I will submit to you that attachment itself is suffering. The very place of being attached, the very craving itself, is suffering itself. It's not the only suffering, but it is a very powerful suffering. Clinging itself is suffering. I mean, the most obvious perhaps is anger. Okay? It hurts. Not just afterwards, it hurts while you are angry. But think of some of the others too. For instance, think of lust, not just sexually, but in that too, but in the sense of the deep craving for that which isn't there at the moment. That is painful. That is an extremely painful thing, to want that badly, that which is not there. Delusion itself, or being in the elsewhere, or playing with those mirrors, is painful. It's painful because it actually hurts to fill the Buddha mind with trash. Because that's what you're doing. This mind is the Buddha mind. The only question is it allowed to shine forth in its immaculacy, or are you going to fill it full of a constant stream of distraction and trash? It hurts to do the latter. It actually physically and mentally hurts. Downers hurt. That's a little more obvious. When you're hurting yourself first so that others don't hurt you, it hurts. So all of these things, right at the very point of the attachment itself, there is suffering. And if that is the case, then there is only one cure, and that is radical sobriety. To stop doing all of that, to give up the attachment itself, the craving itself. That's what I mean by radical sobriety. Giving up the whole thing, because half measures, as they say, half measures in this business do not work. And from the point of view of radical sobriety, every intoxicant, whether it's a grand delusion or a little puff of distractions, is precisely what is getting in its own way. It is that addiction is what guarantees its own frustration, because it separates us from the truth.
It separates us from the source of true contentment, that which simply is. You cannot be one with the universe. You cannot be one with that which is. You cannot be one with all, so long as you will separate yourself from any aspect thereof. So any drug guarantees its own frustration, its own pain. Not surprisingly, therefore, Zen practice is not only fairly similar to the road to recovery from literal addictions, but we add some things to it which bring us to the point of this radical sobriety that I'm talking about. What do we add to the things we have mentioned above? We add meditation, for one. And meditation is radical sobriety, if I've ever seen it. What are you doing there? You're sitting there, alert, aware, present, and when something offers you a fix, you just say no. Now, actually, I will amend that a little, because that sounds a little bit too much like you're shoving it away, okay? When I was in Canada recently, I found it quite fun that the Canadians have a similar anti-drug slogan to our just say no, but theirs, being Canadian, is none for me, thanks. Oh, I love it. Oh, dear. Our friends to the north are so much more polite than we are and gentle about these things than we are. So may I suggest that instead of just say no when distractions and fixes of various sorts offer themselves to you in meditation, effectively you say, none for me, thanks. In other words, you, with a gentle heart, just don't buy it. That's all. You don't shove it away. You just don't smoke any. Thank you very much. You sit there. You allow things to arise, as you well know, and you allow them to pass on. The practice of radical sobriety. And our practice of mindfulness could be looked at as the practice of being satisfied with sobriety. Just when one is practicing mindfulness, one is engaged in the practice that just washing the carrots is enough. And when something offers you a fix, instead, you say, none for me, thanks, and are content with just washing carrots. It's radical sobriety in action. You combine those with what we've looked at before, honest self-examination, faith, trust, willingness, asking for help, sangha, perceptual living, and you end up with a very powerful way of recovery. Whether it be from the three, whether you think of it as the medicine for the three poisons, which is the traditional Buddhist way of looking at it, or whether you think of it as recovery from the three addictions. Now, at this point, my metaphor breaks down, because in literal recovery from literal drug addictions, sobriety is simply sobriety. One ceases destroying oneself and others. And that is a very wonderful thing. I'm not saying that it is not. It's a very wonderful thing. But radical sobriety, sobriety from attachments, from self, goes even farther. It is nothing less than the dropping off of body and mind and the oneness with the eternal Buddha mind, of the unborn. But, ladies and gentlemen, as they say at the end of a good temperance lecture, whether you get with the program or not is up to you. Have a safe and sober New Year. Bet you didn't think you were going to get a good old-fashioned temperance lecture. Hallelujah.